Welcome to The Aging Scientist, focusing on all things science and aging. I'm Clarissa Giebel, and I'm a researcher at the University of Liverpool. This season focuses on some of the basics of dementia. On today's show, I'll be talking to experts about young onset dementia. The majority of people living with dementia are aged 65 and above, and if someone gets a diagnosis from 65 and over, we are referring to late onset dementia. In the UK alone, there are an estimated 920,000 people living with the condition, of which around 40,000 people are estimated to live with young onset dementia. I am joined today by Chris Roberts, his wife Jane Goodrick, and Monica Katians. Chris Roberts is from Wales. He's living with mixed dementia, vascular and Alzheimer's disease dementia. He spends a lot of time raising awareness of dementia, its symptoms, promoting better services and support to dispel the stigma that is associated together with his wife, Jane Goodrick. He's a board member of Alzheimer's Europe, as well as the chair of the European Working Group of People with Dementia and an ambassador for Alzheimer's Society UK and Wales. And he has many other roles that he will go into detail more later. Monica is a psychologist and epidemiologist who has worked in clinical and research roles with people with young onset dementia and their care partners for over a decade. Monica's research currently focuses on post-diagnostic service delivery for young people with dementia, aiming to improve access to high quality person-driven care. So welcome Chris, Jane and Monica. Great to have you on the show.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
So just for our listeners, we have a bit of a time zone difference here as well. We have UK and Australian panelists on this, which is always internationally exciting. So maybe let's start with you, Chris and Jane, if I may. Chris, you're quite renowned for your awareness raising about dementia. And I remember watching the documentary about your day-to-day experiences a few years back, which was really moving. What is your dementia journey been like so far?
It's been really up and down. We didn't know anything about dementia. Why would we? But the more we researched and the more we learned about everything we could, the more we could live with it, and the more we've been able to live with it. It's all about support and understanding. And how can you care or for someone or look after yourself even if you know nothing about what's going on? You know, so that and being honest as well has made such a huge difference. Coming out, as it were, you know, and having honest conversations with the family, with friends, and also taking the time to tell friends and even strangers about it. Because it's a hidden illness, and you know, because I always get, "Don't you look well?" Well, I do. it's inside my brain, and I ground people a lot by saying, "Well, I also have emphysema, a form of COPD. You can't see that either," and that really gets people thinking. But if you don't let people know that you need support, that you have, you know, various disabilities and problems, then how can they help you if they can't see it? I remember using a stick for a while after my last stroke. And
a walking stick.
Yeah. And that was a visual clue to people. And I saw how good people would be, that they would wave me across the road or they would let me sit down on a train or a bus. And that doesn't happen if they don't see anything. But and why should it? You know, they're not mind readers. So I think that's helped us a lot, hasn't it?
It did also give them a clue that if Chris stepped into the road, perhaps a little bit unexpectedly, when he had the stick, they were more prepared to stop, or they were more expecting that he might step into the road. They saw that there was more of a difficulty than if he'd just been walking along without the stick. So that visual clue was very good for people. Mm-hmm. But initially, we knew nothing about dementia. And it threw us, it completely threw us, because it was a topic that never touched our lives. As Chris has said, it's better to find out as much as you can. And then there are good days and bad days. But we have noticed that whilst we've done as much as we can, things do progress no matter what we can do.
Yeah, my biggest barrier is my progression and having these good and bad days. And I never promote living well, because I think that's a bit of a daft phrase. I don't know who come up with that. Who lives well anyway? You know, with bills and financial problems and children and grandchildren. You know, and then you're given a life-changing diagnosis, because it does or should change your life, otherwise you won't be able to live with it properly. And all of a sudden, everyone around you is saying, but you can live well. And it puts a lot of pressure on people, an awful lot of pressure. I think you can live with it. You have to live with it, or you're going to die from it. But living well is not a phrase that I totally agree with. I don't think should be voted a lot, but you should be promoting, well, I do anyway, that you can live with it or alongside it, as Kate Swofford says a lot in Australia, going back to Monica. And I think that's what you've got to do. We look for, we never look for problems, we look for the solutions. That's what we've learned to do, mainly down to my youngest daughter, who started doing that naturally. And it's if I can't find a solution, or we can't find a solution to adapt or help or support, then we disregard it. It doesn't exist, you know, and don't worry about it. I stopped writing. I almost started writing my own language, and I couldn't understand it, and neither could anyone else. And it just got more and more intelligible. And I sat down with my daughter, and we realized that I couldn't see the letters in my head anymore. So I was just making it up as I went along. And we sat down on the computer, and I could still type, because the letters were in front of me as a reminder. But then as my skills became less, I struggled to use the computer then. But then we realized it was a case of multitasking, you know. So we started using a tablet, which is touchscreen, and it's just about finding ways around things as you do in normal life anyway, you know.
So instead of having to use a computer screen, a keyboard, and a mouse, Chris just has the one item, and everything is done on that touchscreen item, and that has simplified the process. One of the solutions we came up with was Chris was no longer able to make a cup of coffee, and the main problem was the kettle. It was awkward to open the lid. So we got a push button kettle, and we painted the push button pink, having daughters in the house, so that he could see the black on black. So these are the type of things when we say find a solution. It doesn't need to be technical. It doesn't need to be highfalutin. It doesn't need to be dementia specific. It's finding the solution to what is the problem. The key is finding what is the problem. In our case, Chris couldn't make coffee because of the item that disabled him. We found one that reabled him, and he still makes coffee.
And I think with younger onset, you're more open to adapting and changing your life, you know, to oppose to people in their 80s or 90s, you know, because they're stuck in the ways. And yeah, I get that. I also see a lot that people with younger onset have still mostly got their faculties, and, you know, they haven't deteriorated, as you do with age anyway. And they have a lot more sensory issues because of that. That's what I think anyway, and that's what I've experienced.
It's also that I think with younger types of dementia, and Monica will chip in there in a bit as well, it's they're more varied subtypes, as far as I'm aware, than they are with late onset dementia. So with late onset, the much more people are having Alzheimer's disease dementia than compared to in young onset dementia. But you were referring to a lot of really important things here, both you, Chris, and Jane, and like the hidden illness angle really like stands out there as well. We can't see it. And I think I hear that so much when I speak to family members or people living with dementia, when they go to a supermarket or something, or go to a shop, or go and try and take public transport. They may be a little bit slower in doing the activity, paying for the ticket or whatever. And there's often this in acceptance or like disregard for it from the shops or from the bus driver or whatever, not acknowledging it because they don't see anything that is apparently wrong. Have you encountered that as well?
I have, but I find it's very rare, because customer service is so good these days, staff are so good these days, you know, with everybody. I don't find that I get rushed at all, really.
I'm going to interject there, because now we have the contactless debit card. When Chris was having to sort change or to pay by cash, that was a very different situation. And that was years ago. So although Chris doesn't have the same problems you had years ago, it's because we now have the contactless debit card, so he can easily pay in one simple movement. Before, having to look at his change, having to get notes out, he could appear drunk. He could appear like he didn't know what he was doing. So technology has advanced to support people with dementia in a completely, a different way. You know, it was to help everybody, but actually things have become very dementia friendly just because they are.
Yeah, I'm using the debit card. Jane immediately knows if I've spent any money, where I am.
I get an immediate notification that £5 has been spent in such and such a place.
So it's almost like a tracking device.
So on one occasion where Chris and I were separated and he wasn't where he was supposed to be, I went onto my banking app, and actually I saw it was me. I hadn't looked for him properly in this particular establishment, and he was tucked behind the corner. So it's a very good tracking tool as well.
That's fascinating, because from our research, we usually hear a little bit more negative experience about everything being digitalized for particularly older people with dementia and Zoom and everything. But I like that positive angle on technology, that it can actually help in certain ways.
I don't have to remember a PIN. I can't sign anything because I can't write. So that is so simple. And I do struggle with coins. My sight isn't good some days. Some days I can't read text on black and white because it starts to jump around and I lose focus, you know, and it's all these things. I can go to a restaurant now with my wife, and I can bring up the menu usually through their website. And so I can make it as big as I want, or I can change the color. And it's so much, but you don't know what you don't know. You know, you have to learn all these things. And then I have to be reminded that I can do all these things by my wife and family as well.
He can also have that dignity of paying for the meal in a restaurant, you know, because we've now had the increase of the amount that you can use contactless. So that has actually increased Chris's ability, Chris's dignity when we do go out. He can go up to the bar and order 2 pints and pay, because it's much less complex.
Or 3. And if I get the number wrong, we'll give it to someone else. You know, it's not about getting things right. It's about just doing.
Just getting on with it, isn't it?
It doesn't matter if you get things wrong. It doesn't matter if you forget. And it's very difficult to get over these things. But when you do, life becomes a lot better. And we learned very early on that the more you do for me, the less I'm able to do eventually, because I do forget very quickly, especially these days. It wasn't about memory in the beginning, but memory is a big part now. And Jane was very hands-on when I first got diagnosed, because that's what you do. You know, you try and look after someone. You explain it better.
So he's given a diagnosis of a debilitating illness. Therefore, whatever illness it would have been, my job is to look after him. So you go in, you wrap them in cotton wool, feed them chicken soup, take over doing all their tasks. And that is absolutely the worst thing we can do with somebody with dementia. But it's what we do instinctively. Somebody's poorly, we try to look after them and make them better. And to make somebody with dementia better is actually hands off. Let them do as much as they can. Be there to stop them falling, but allow them to go to the point where you don't know when they're going to fall. So you have to find out where that point is. But going back to the, if we look at specifically young onset, this debit card thing has enabled Chris to take his children out. Now, our children are adults now, but earlier...
No, they take me out.
Yeah, they take you out. But there's none of this embarrassment with the child having to look after the father. The father can still be a father, and the parental guidance can be there, and the dignity of paying for the bus fares. Mm. Or the coffees or whatever.
And I'm not sure in England, but in Wales, I get a disability bus pass because of my dementia and also my COPD. And it's got a little plus sign on it, which means that anyone else can travel with me as well for free on the buses. My kids thought that was brilliant, and they used to want to take me to see chick flicks and take me to McDonald's. And
and that gave me a break, but it also gave Chris adult time, parental, father time with his daughters, with none of the stigma of them having to pay or sort dad's change out.
Yeah. So I was accompanied, but I was also independent. They got free bus travel and I paid for the McDonald's.
Subway, wasn't it?
Subway, yeah.
I like your attitude towards it. It's refreshing to hear from both of you much more about just getting on with it and take it step by step, isn't it? And taking those salute, being proactive about it.
I think being diagnosed with emphysema first, which limits my life as well, because my breathing, I've lost lung capacity. That was supposed to kill me a few years ago, you know? So you learn that not everything kills you.
And just makes you stronger.
You're going to die anyway.
Monica, what about your research in Australia? How does that resonate with Chris and Jane have just discussed and shared?
Yeah, I've just been listening with such interest and kind of jotting things down as you've been talking, because so much of it resonates so deeply with what the research tells us and what our experiences working with other young people with dementia tell us. And I think it really speaks to the universality of some of these experiences, whether you live in Wales or down here in Australia, there are such common experiences. I particularly picked up, Chris, on what you said about you don't know what you don't know. And I think that really sums up where we're at, certainly here in Australia, but I think most places in the world, in terms of the big missing pieces of care and support for people with young onset dementia. And that is particularly in those early stages, you know, leading up to diagnosis and in the early months and years after diagnosis, that people with young onset dementia and their families are sort of muddling through and doing their best to figure these things out. That you two have, you're clearly a well-oiled machine here and a, you know, problem-solving machines really at this point. But what we see routinely is that people are diagnosed. There's very few kind of navigational supports and very few resources that help them to figure out how to manage this illness, plus come to terms with what you talked about in terms of the grief and loss and the psychological kind of coming to terms with the diagnosis too. It's a really difficult time. People are problem solving on the go and learning as they go. And that I think is an area in which we can do a lot better as service providers and as support systems to make that transition into living alongside dementia a little more smooth.
So, Chris and Jane, how did you find out anything about dementia? Because you were both saying we didn't know anything. How did you approach that?
Well, I'm just going to step in here and say it may be the same for older people, I don't know, but certainly with young, my experience is that the symptoms that start to come about with dementia that Chris were displaying, they could have broken our marriage. We could have ended up divorced because he was having what I thought was a midlife crisis.
You wish.
I was starting with menopause. You know, so there's all these confounding factors that come in. Chris blamed everything on me starting with menopause. I blamed everything on him having a midlife crisis. So it was very, and I know people that whose marriages have been this close to breaking up.
It was a blame game because we didn't have any other answers.
That's right. I think that you really hit the nail on the head there, Jane, that there are unique challenges associated with being in midlife. You know, usually we are at the peak of our financial family responsibilities, our occupational responsibilities. We are, a lot of people are relying on us in our midlife. And also we are also going through things like menopause, and we're also going through things like, you know, all the psychological things that come with moving into the later part of our lives. And so, you know, these things alone make a diagnosis and an onset of a dementia far more tricky and far more complicated, and, you know, really complex. And I think that's something that's really unique about young onset dementia, is that you've got so many aspects of somebody's life that need support. It's those layers of complexity that are added, for sure.
Certainly in our case, there was the, you know, we've still got a mortgage even now. Our daughter, one of the daughters has gone to university. There's a lot of financial, additional financial considerations that I don't think we would have if we were in our 70s. But a friend of ours was this close to divorcing her husband. He has had a diagnosis of frontotemporal, and she is now stuck. She's having to stay with him. The marriage is over because of the dementia symptoms, but it took them a long time to realise and get a diagnosis, and now she cannot leave. So there are these emotional aspects. So she's now feeling trapped in a loveless marriage for a different reason. Had the diagnosis come earlier, their marriage may be stronger than it is now.
But we got involved through our memory assessment services with a research project through Bangor University with Professor Bob Woods, and a group of us were left to talk on our own in the memory services about certain subjects, and we got to be friends.
A group of people with dementia.
Yeah, a group of people with dementia, and we all got to be friends and realised, and it was a varied age group, and we realised that it wasn't about age at all. You know, yes, there are differences, but there's so many similarities as well. And I started going to a care home for respite because that's what I was offered. That's all we were offered at the time. And I thought Jane deserved to have a break from me because that's what I was told. We do things differently now, if we've been handed a bit of an advice book, you know, you will experience this, you can approach these people for help, you might experience this, you can approach these people for help. We didn't know what an OT was. We didn't know what a social worker could do. Jane thought social worker was going to take me and put me in a care home. So the last person we want to speak to was a social worker.
Because she would be assessing my care of Chris. And, you know, I'm not the world's natural carer.
No.
So she would obviously see that he was in some kind of safeguarding issue, I think they call it.
Yeah, because I was left to my own devices. But anyway, but through this research project that I didn't want to take part in at first, because I didn't want to sit with people with dementia, who would? And found out they're all just like me, you know. And then I started to realise that there's much more to this. And that's when we started just researching and, you know, and Googling, and Dr. Google was our best friend, but also our worst enemy sometimes.
But she asked, how did we know what gave us an idea to go to the doctor in the first instance?
Did you?
Yeah, but anyway.
Oh, because I was getting very, I'm still working, obviously, and driving, and I was starting to take different routes, and even I didn't know why I was taking them. I was getting very unorganized, which was totally unlike me. I would be making journeys backwards and forwards because I'd forgotten tools and things for my job. And I used to cover all this because what would I come home and discuss? You know, I'm going a bit doolally, I'm going a bit daft.
I took the drill today to change a lock. I had to come back for the battery. I then had to go and buy the lock. I then had to go and buy hinges for the... So
yeah, you don't come home and discuss how stupid you've been that day. So you start to hide it. And that's what I did. I just blagged it, really, you know, and just learnt, it's just something that's going on. It's the male menopause. you do start to hide things, you know. And I would quite often completely forget where I was going and what I was doing, which was unlike me. So I'd start to put post-it notes. I'd start to look around the car to see if there's any evidence of where I was going, what tools I was carrying, to try and, you know, try and remember. And I would sit in the lay-by sometimes for an hour or 2 hours trying to work it out. And then I would go, if I didn't remember, I'd go back home and just say...
Yeah, so that really reflects what we know, I guess, from the research about diagnosis and why it can take so long for people with young onset dementia to get a diagnosis. The research tells us that it takes an average of 4 years from symptom onset for a person with young onset dementia to actually receive a formal diagnosis. And partly that is because of exactly what you say there, Chris, about the person themselves or their family not kind of recognizing that this is... you know, a disease process, that something's going on. You know, I'm only 55, you know, obviously this is not dementia. I've just got kind of going a bit batty, or I'm a bit stressed, or I'm maybe a bit depressed, yeah. These kinds of things. And so, and then we extend that, you know, you go to see your physician, your general practitioner, and they too think, no, well, you're only 55. So of course it's not dementia. I won't refer you to a neurologist. And then, you know, if you do get to see a neurologist or a specialist, sometimes they're even questioning, you know, it's probably depression, it's probably something else, which is, that is based in science. It is, you know, the symptoms of depression and psychiatric illness can look a bit like dementia sometimes. And, you know, so that's a good thing for doctors to rule that out. But all of these factors add up over time to mean that people end up waiting for that diagnosis. And by the time it comes, sometimes... Well, oftentimes we hear that it's actually a relief to finally get that.
And that's what we felt on diagnosis. It was just a relief that I now had a label. You know, we knew what they were looking at, but to get the diagnosis was actual a relief. I had a label. I wasn't going mad. I didn't have a brain tumour, which Jane thought or hoped I had, as opposed to dementia, because she didn't want a husband with dementia.
No, I thought the little I knew of dementia, it was hopeless. A brain tumour, well, potentially they might be able to operate, and there is a little bit of hope. There's something they can do. At that point in time, I didn't think anything could be done for dementia. And, you know, I've obviously learned a lot more now. But because there was no cure, therefore, brain tumour was the best option because potentially there might be a cure. That's the mental state we were in.
Yeah, I think the work that both of you are doing, though, in terms of awareness raising has really highlighted that, at least in the UK, to many people that, yes, it's, I'm not going to use the term living well with dementia, Chris, because you don't like that, but you can live with dementia and you can continue being active and doing your things as much as possible, especially when you have a lovely support network with your family, Chris.
Absolutely. It's not all hopelessness, you know. I do suffer, you know. I hate being labelled as a sufferer, and that's what people get wrong these days. All of a sudden, you can't use this word, especially on social media, which I get a lot of flack for. But I do suffer. I don't want to be labelled a sufferer. I'm more than that. I'm a person who has some failings and has an illness. But I do suffer. My family suffers. They suffer more than me, you know. And I'm the lucky one. As a friend of mine, Tommy from Liverpool, he says that we're actually the lucky ones, because if we live long enough, we'll eventually forget. The family never have that luxury, you know. And it is about getting on with it. And you know, I forgot what I was going to say.
Interesting way of looking at it, but I know what you mean, Chris. Yes.
And for the people that don't raise awareness with the illness, you don't have to. We've all got our own ways of dealing with it. It down to who you were before. You know, I've always been outspoken. I've always been quite loud and stuff. And I've always been busy and focused. And I was completely lost after the diagnosis because I had no focus. I thought I was going to die very soon. I was living with guilt of what I'd done to my family, what I thought I'd done. I was living in a financial mess and things like that. Depression moved in, you know, and along with guilt. And it's a horrible place to be in. But I got the focus back by taking part and being valued in research projects, and then moved on from there. And dementia became my new job, as it were, because it's something I could talk about.
You know, it gives you structure and new purpose, doesn't it?
Exactly. Not everyone wants to talk about, and that's fine. You don't have to be me.
No. So can I just pick up on what Monica was saying? Because we know generally that a diagnosis of young onset takes generally a bit longer than people who are in the later stages of their lives.
That's a good thing, though, because you want to be sure, you want a correct diagnosis, don't you? I think that's a good thing.
Okay, so...
I would hate to have my diagnosis rushed. But the problem is, you don't receive any support while the diagnosis is taking place. If you receive more support and they discussed with what help they can do and what they're looking at, but no one wants to mention the word while this diagnosis process is going on. And I'm like, well, it's okay. You can talk about dementia, you know? And if I haven't got it at the end, you say you haven't got it. And I go, yahoo.
Jane, would you agree with that? Because you just mentioned before you were thinking, oh, is he in a midlife crisis for all those years?
I think we were extremely fortunate because of Chris's emphysema, and we told you a little bit about the symptoms outside of home that we never saw. Inside the home, we were becoming a little bit argumentative. We were asked, shall we watch a DVD? Yeah, let's watch a DVD. We'd choose a DVD. Chris would leave the room, come back in. Shall we watch a DVD? And it's like, you've just asked us this. There were all various things going on in the home that afterwards we realised were down to the dementia. But because of Chris's emphysema, we went very, very early to the doctors, to the GP, because Chris likened his scatterness to being a mountaineer, lack of oxygen to the brain, you know, going to high altitude. And, you know, so we went to the GP and I asked to see a chest physician. She said, why, what's the problem with my treatment? Because he's very early in the emphysema. And so we told her the symptoms and she went, that's not emphysema. So we were there very, very early. And I often wonder how long it would have taken us to realise there was a cognitive problem to see the GP. As it happens, because of his other problem, we were diagnosed before, I think, really extremely early. And the GP knew Chris personally outside of the surgery, so in the motorbike helped. Community.
Yeah.
So she asked, you know, could it be depression? Could it be stress? And we said, well, we don't know, you're the GP, but we don't believe we're under stress and we don't believe it's depression. We did go down that route. But within a month, we'd gone on a motorbike ride and Chris had been completely lost, didn't know where he was going. And because it's a motorbike, we're not having a conversation until he gets a beating on the back of the shoulder. Turn off the motorway. We were heading halfway to Manchester.
All right.
Instead of turning for Chester. And this is all at the same time. And we went back to the GP to discuss the treatment that she'd put him on antidepressants. And I'd said, hallelujah, they worked miraculously. But the follow-up appointment with that is actually he got lost. And she did the MMSE.
Yeah.
And that's where we knew what we were looking at. He did dreadfully on that. And when we did actually see we saw a psychiatrist, because the GP said, I don't know whether to send you to a psychiatrist or a neurologist, to the memory clinic or a neurologist. And she sent us to the memory clinic, because through the memory clinic, we also saw a neurologist in the end anyway. This is just the way it worked with our particular area. And that's when the testing started. So from the point of presenting to the GP, to Chris getting a diagnosis of mixed dementia was 13 months. And that's what Chris means when he says he doesn't mind it taking a long time. I don't think you mean taking a long time before anybody takes you seriously. It's actually the diagnostic process should not be rushed so that you get an accurate diagnosis, rather than not going to the GP early.
Absolutely. What about your research, Monica? You're looking more at post-diagnostic angle, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, we've done a bit of research about diagnosis and the process of getting access to a diagnosis. Particularly here in Australia, one of the big challenges that we have is that we're a really, really big place, and that we are spread quite thinly across that very big area. And so you might have one person with young onset dementia in your town and maybe within the five towns around you, which all might be 500 kilometres apart from each other. So, you know, in a geographical context like that, providing timely health services, diagnostic services to everyone is a huge challenge. We have very good, high-quality systems in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane. But if you live outside of those big cities or a long way from those big cities, the equity in that access to the care and the treatment is poor. And so that's a big thing that our research is really focusing on and interested in at the moment. How do we use things like telehealth, and how do we use mobile technologies and other strategies to overcome some of these barriers to receiving a diagnosis, and then of course receiving the kind of care that you need after that. And then I guess the other big focus of our research at the moment again picks up quite strongly on some things that Chris and Jane have mentioned about, you know, there's this real duality when we talk to young people with dementia and their families. There's a real desire to be in control and in charge of my own life and my own care and my own support systems and my own strategies, that I'm in the driver's seat of all of that. But at the same time, I feel lost. I don't really know what to do. I don't really have the support that I need around me to make that happen. And so that tension between I want to be in charge, but I also need support when I need it, is of real interest to us. And so we're doing quite a bit of research at the moment about, again, how things like technology, how services can be set up to promote that, to give you the support that you need when you need it, but also allow you to identify your own needs, identify the needs of the people around you, and take action and recognise when you need to reach out. So these kinds of that balancing act, whereas we know that older people with dementia, while they do like to be in charge of their care, what we notice that it's not quite so much. You know, people in their midlife are used to being in the command seat of their life. If you are the CEO of a company and you're 55, you know, you are in charge, right? And so often that also means you want to be in charge of your dementia journey, of your life. And so we're quite interested in interventions and strategies to support people to do that.
So would you say in the past, I don't know, 10, 20 years or something in Australia, that care has been improving for specifically young onset, and in what way?
Yeah, certainly it has improved, and there's lots of kind of contextual and political stuff that's specific to Australia that I won't bore you with. Basically, one of the key things the major thing that has happened in the last decade or two is that dementia care used to be completely delivered in the aged care system. So even if you were under 65, aged care providers would provide dementia care for you. Whereas now, in the last about 7 years ago, care for young people with dementia moved to the disability system or the social care system here. And that was a real revolution for people with young onset dementia in this country, because the disability system is very strengths-based. It's very individualised. It's about, you know, what are your goals and what are your rehabilitation goals, your reablement goals, and what do we put in place to accommodate that and support you to do that, rather than the typical aged care approach, which is, well, you can't do that, so let's just do it for you, or let's just kind of do, you know, do as little, you know, as much as we can for you so that you don't have to do anything, which we know is quite disabling in itself. So that has been a really positive step. But we still encounter common problems. For example, there's actually no service providers anywhere near where I live, or there's actually no service providers anywhere near me who know anything about dementia or about young onset dementia. So, you know, we still have problems, but things are definitely better than they used to be. And we, our research has told us that people are happier than they used to be with their services now.
Oh, absolutely. We've seen a major difference in the last 10 years. But there's still this problem with being reactive and not proactive. You know, usually the services are very reactive and you don't get help until you're in a crisis and then it's too late. We all need to know, we need some kind of handbook again that gives us all these choices in advance. So then the people know what to ask for, because if you don't ask, you don't get a reaction. And how can you ask for something that you don't know about?
I think that seems reflected in late onset dementia in the research. I mean, my research spans across any age, but I hear it also a lot from people with later onset dementia that either they get bombarded with information at the time of diagnosis, which is so stressful, emotionally upsetting, it can be, and just overwhelming, or they don't get anything. Like throughout, it should be really like a little pieces throughout the step. And also what seems to be missing either in young onset or late onset is that one particular point of call that or person, contact person that they can have a chat with. This is happening now. Can I have some advice? Do you have that in Australia, Monica? Like this one contact person?
That is such a good question, because we actually did have that for some time. We had a special initiative of workers called Key Workers that worked for our Peak Dementia organisation, and that was highly, highly valued where it was used by people with young onset dementia. Unfortunately, the government discontinued funding for that program a few years ago, which was really disappointing. But yeah, certainly, you know, we have a bit of a model from that situation that is a really helpful thing if it can be, I suppose, from a government perspective, it has to be kind of financially viable, and that's a difficult thing to demonstrate when you have what is technically a rare disease, even though we do have that, you know, we still have 27,000 people here in Australia with young onset dementia, so it's a challenge for sure.
So I noticed we're coming up to our kind of time here. Time flies when you're having fun, I think, speaking to all of you. But I want to ask all of you one final question. So maybe start with you, Chris and Jane. If there's one thing you could change within dementia care, what would it be?
I think I would like to, two things really. I'd like to see the word dementia dropped. It encompasses a whole load of illnesses and diseases, and puts us all into one small container, you know, and that's a problem with services. Then they're not looking at the actual cause. And the other thing about being less ageist and more stage appropriate. I've got some friends in their 80s and 90s, you know, and they're really good friends, and you get to a certain age, I think, you know, in your 40s or 50s, where age doesn't come into it anymore. But the services should be more stage appropriate. You know, no one wants to sit with people in their later stages if you're in early stages, and people don't want to sit with people in early stages looking like they're doing really well when you're really struggling. And that's what I found in the care home, you know, and the nursing homes. You're all put in one room, and there's nothing to encourage anyone to do better. You either feel resentful because someone's doing better than you, or you feel terrible because that's, you're looking at your future.
Okay,
I think we ought to back off a little bit from maybe age, young or old, and just look at stage appropriate services.
Okay, that's really interesting. I can see that, especially in the care home and respite sector.
I've got this all encompassing, is that the word? Dementia, you know?
from my point of view, it's about, as Chris said earlier, it's about proaction, not reaction. We don't know what we don't know. The system in the UK is you get your diagnosis, everything, or the social worker comes in, everything stabilizes, so you are signed off, you're discharged. Now, we now understand what that means. But when you're first told that you're discharged, you're like, no, 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 I need you now, because usually it's like 9 months down the line, things are starting to change. But because things are stabilised, you're discharged from that particular service or that particular...
People think they're not going to get any help
anymore. And yet you feel abandoned. You think that's it. So we now know how to go about getting the support we need. But that's because we do all of this work and we're actually involved in commissioning the support in our area and helping to design the support that we actually have in Wales. So proaction, not reaction. Don't wait for me to go into a crisis and end up on your desk as another statistic. Be proactive.